Well, you can tell I'm well prepared. So I'm Julia Longton. I'm working on a slicer. So this is based on my work on a Haskell-based slicer. So who am I? Why did I even start this? I'm a free software developer, a heavy Haskeller. So I write Haskell all day whenever I'm not working. I'm the maintainer of ImplicitCAD, which is a 3D modeling system that is written in Haskell. And I'm also, I've spent the last 3 years developing a slicer, which I've unimaginatively called HSlice. I do work at Wire.com, but this presentation has nothing to do with any of the things I do with my employer. So I'm from Washington, D.C., and from Northwest Arkansas. So I'm from the United States, both very nice parts of it and very not nice parts of it. So that's part of why I work on things like this. I've lived in Berlin with my wife for the last 4 years. I am a transhumanist, a heavy Haskeller, and, well, I wrote down cyberpunk enthusiast, which really just means... Okay, once more with feeling. So that really just means I spend too much time watching Ghost in the Shell and other cyberpunk anime and various movies and thinking about how technology could be improving my life. So I wrote I previously have done some work that I presented at 31C3, which was basically using a microwave to produce 3D printed aluminum parts. I have not been doing that here since I have moved to Germany, but that is part of what gave me the impetus to the sort of the bravado to think that I could try to write a slicer. So I'm here because I'm writing a new type of slicer. I'm hoping that a new slicer is going to be able to help 3D printing technology be a little more useful to, not just us who are designing 3D printed parts and printing them in our printers, but the people who are actually using them in the end. The reason I started this project is, if you remember, about 3 years ago, there was some work on non-planar slicing, so slicing that actually did not pile things on top of each other, like we're printing just various weirdly shaped pancakes, but something that went down sides and down edges. So I'm wanting better slicers, and in the last 3 years since I've seen that, nobody has managed to get that into any of the main lines of any of the projects, and it's still kind of an experiment that everybody uses. I want parallel slicers, so we all have multi-core machines nowadays, but at the end of that, we use a slicer that has mostly single-threaded algorithms and single-threaded components. I want increased precision and increased speed because, well, I want bioprinting that actually works. So before I started on this project, my 3D printer workflow basically was open a text editor, write a model of a thing, give it to my 3D modeling system, get out an STL, see whether that STL is anything resembling the object I'm looking for. If it is, I hand it to a slicer, and that slicer, it generates the print job, but it takes a long time, and I mean, I've spent quite a long time waiting for a print slice. And when I looked at what was going on, it's basically just one CPU sitting there being railed and none of the other cores operating. So I take that out, and I
put that in my printer. I print, and that also takes a long time. But that's a mechanical problem. That's not a that's not something that, as a programmer, I can try to solve. So then I wait, and I get a thing. So Implicit CAD is kind of what I started with. It's my 3D printing stack, or the first half of my 3D printing stack, rather. Written in Haskell. There's an online editor. Source code is available. It's all AGPL'd, as I think most of these things should be. It will take a description of my object, and it will produce a STL of it, which is basically just triangles on the outside of where the object should be. It's highly parallelized because it's a Haskell program that uses a marching cubes algorithm, which we can very easily parallelize. So I built a system for myself for this that has like 28 cores, 384 gigs of RAM, just, you know, a real machine to run it against. But whenever I try to run a slicer on that, it's using one core. So that was problems for me. And what's worse is to get 28 cores, I went and got like these little 1.7 gigahertz cores. So it takes a long time. So the job of a slicer is it reads a file that contains one or more objects. The objects are, as I said, a set of triangles on the exterior. It divides the object into layers, computes instructions that fill in those layers. If it has different layer heights, that gives you different roughnesses of the outside surface. So it also gives instructions for managing the non-geometry parts of the print, making sure that the plastic is at the right temperature and flowing, making sure the fans are on if it's trying to do overhangs and it needs something to solidify in the middle of air. And, you know, it writes a G-code file, which is basically just instructions for the printer that go from point A to point B, extrude this amount of material, move this fast. So that is what slicers are, you know, that's what a slicer's job is. But whenever it's using algorithms that are single-threaded, this becomes problematic because I just sit there waiting forever. So why do we need better slicers? Performance. Scalability, number of CPUs is a really big one for me right now since my machine just kind of sits there and stalls when I need to go slice something. Additionally, the slicers that we have are all written in imperative languages. This is causing problems whenever we need to move it to something like using a GPU to do your slicer or using a FPGA to do your slicing or any of these massive parallel tools that we use. We also could use higher precision in our slicing. So one of the things that I've been experimenting with is we have floating point units in our machines, and we're all stuck with the same floating point units, but there's different math you can use that will utilize those floating point units in a more it'll utilize them more operations, which will give you higher precision, even though you're using the same hardware. Additionally, I want printing to get more useful, and in order for that to happen, we have to be able to print larger things, or at least more complicated things. The top one at my, the one that bounces off the top of my head is always bioprinting. We are meat machines. We should be able to repair those machines. So the reason that I, started work on this was I saw some non-planar slicing. This is particularly the one that inspired this work. What did I think I would do differently whenever I sat down to start a slicer? Well, I thought that this was going to be a 6-month project. This is year 3, and actually it's about year 3.5, and I think I have about another year and a half in front of me at this point. So one of my coworkers mentioned that you should maintain a budget of innovation tokens. If you make a decision, then that's going to cost you tokens, and you're going to have to pay for choices that are more promising and, you know, are risky. When you run out of tokens, you should just generally do what everybody else is doing in the industry. Well, My first innovation token was I used Haskell to do this. It's a functional programming language. It is lazy, so it does not perform an operation until that operation is actually needed. So it will go back and do its homework whenever you actually try to reference something. It separates pure from impure code. So what that means is that, you know, the pure code I'm able to run, or that you're able to run on things like FPGAs or GPUs or, you know, pure code does not have any state that stays in it. So every time you call a function with exactly these arguments, no matter what happens, you're going to get exactly the same result. That is one of the nice things about pure programming. I thought I would build my own geometry engine. So there are a bunch of geometry engines that are in use by other slicers. Some of them date back to the 80s, and they have algorithms that, you know, they do date back quite a bit. So I decided I would write my own, try to use some more advanced algorithms, some of the newer techniques and technologies. And that also let me avoid interfacing with non-Haskell code, which means that my code could actually take advantage of all the parallelization and all of the GPU acceleration or FPGA acceleration, or I think honestly we can probably do AI engine acceleration nowadays. So you can utilize those components. I also thought I would use a new type of algebra, projective geometric algebra. It uses one more datum for every item that we're working with. So if you're looking at a 2D point, you really have three values. This means you're doing math against three values. And since you're doing math against three values, generally I think that we're going to end up with more precision there. That was my theory anyway. This is the 2-hour-long talk that actually convinced me to do this. Somebody out there actually pointed this out to me, and at the point at which I saw that, it's good stuff. So I also decided to use, of course, new geometry algorithms. Specifically, I'm looking at some stuff from Christopher Cherney. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I don't actually know. Welcome to the internet. So, how did I get started on this? Step one, I did not do this from scratch. I started by I did a search to see if anybody else had actually done this before, written a slicer in Haskell, and I found one that was written by a couple of university students, and I went ahead and built on top of it. It already had a little bit of the math I needed, but as I'll show later, it was missing some heavy components. Like, there was no test suite, or I guess technically there was one test, but I have no idea what it was supposed to produce, so that was a good test. It did fill in layers of a print, but it would not do this if the object had any sort of jutting inward in the object. So as long as the object was basically round or basically square or basically, you know, a basic shape, it was fine. So how did this process go? Well, obviously I'm standing here 3 years later, so it didn't necessarily go the best. As I've maintained implicit CAD for quite a number of years, Haskell generally got out of my way. The floating point rounding is a separate library, which is only working on GHC 9, not 9.2. So I think that was the roughest thing that using Haskell gave me, was I didn't have the type of precise control over floating point operations that I wanted. Since I wrote this for 3 years, and Haskell is something that you learn as you go, then I ended up in kind of a loop where I would go back to a portion of the program and go, well, who wrote this crap? And it was me. So the compiler and type system were working closely with me. That was nice about it. And when I was implementing a function, I used a very light implementation, just implement what you know you need to get this test to run, and then abandon all hope, call the error function, and you can build up your test suite at least. When I went to add geometric algebra, there was no geometric algebra library for Haskell, so I wrote one, and that was a bit complicated because the papers I was using, they didn't really detail what operators they were using, or more to the point, they would use multiply to mean a lot of things, and yeah, trying to figure out what that actually meant to me, well, I'm not a very highly educated in the maths type of individual, so it took me a little bit of time. Also, there's a bug somewhere in my code, and the origin point doesn't work because of how I implemented all of this. So just never put anything on 0, 0, and you're fine. So resources to prevent the same mistakes. These are, well, first, the bivector PDF that I show here has all the geometric operators, and there are two versions of this out there in the field, one of which actually has all of the how you implement the operators in it, and that's this one. The other one kind of kept me confused for a month because it was missing one of the columns. Also, the code, of course, is on GitHub, and it's all in one file, so there is a single file implementation of geometric algebra. So once I had the geometric algebra working, I could actually work on the projective geometric algebra. This was a long and painful process. It's probably still a little bit incomplete because I am still working on some of the error handling in the floating point operations, so I can throw a couple of million operations at it, and every now and then something will pop out and be incorrect. So there are many papers which are all written generally by the same guy who is here in Berlin, Charles Gunn, and his papers are reasonable, but he's also a mathematician, so it was a little bit difficult for me to get through some of this. Additionally, there was the question of normalizing or canonicalizing, or, you know, it basically was situations where, okay, I've done a little bit of math and I have a result in my hand, and now I hand that result to another function, and before I can hand that result to another function, I have to run this function against it in order for it to be usable. It was a bit confusing. So I used the type system of Haskell to only normalize or canonicalize whenever it was required. This was handy. And finding some of the symmetry breaking operations was difficult with this. So one of the things that they're particularly proud of is that you can use the same operators on a whole bunch of different objects, and they'll always give you an answer that is sane. But the problem here is that I needed answers that were, you know, insane. So I needed to know whether a line was pointing to the left of this line, or a line was pointing to the right of this line, or functions like this were difficult to find. So what I think is the best of Charles's papers is the first one here. There's also a geometric algebra, or projective geometric algebra discourse. So I've posted a couple of questions there, and you can get the authors of the paper to respond, which is nice. And again, I implemented everything in one single file, so I have one file that has all of my PGA operations in it. So then I went to the part where I have to actually implement new geometry algorithms. This was, yeah, longer and painful. I had to get into an entirely new area of math to me that I didn't even know existed, and honestly, when I went to search for other people who had developed slicers, part of the problem was I would find that they had all gotten to about the same point, and then they looked at straight skeleton algorithms, and then they abandoned all hope. So there are several different slicers out there that got basically to that point and then gave up. So I found one paper on the subject that's very approachable, which is was actually useful for what I was looking at, which is Christopher Cherney's work, which is here. And hopefully this talk will be a bit on the useful side for this. So what did I get when I was done? What do I have to show for 3 years now of 3.5 years of late nights? So I have a slicer. It has a geometric algebra library. There's floating point error tracking on the geometric algebra library, so I know approximately how much error I actually got each time I did an operation. This is nice. I have the library supports a mixed Euclidean and projective engine. So what that effectively means is we have lines and we have line segments, and they are both in the library and can be reasoned with at the same time. There is a parallel straight skeleton solver in there, which I haven't seen any real parallel straight skeleton work at all, and I'll show you some of that here in a moment. It's implemented as a binary that tries to emulate the command line arguments of the Cura slicing engine. My hope is that eventually I can just plug Cura's front end into this back end and have something useful, but that's still hope. There's just a hair more precision in what I've been doing. So if I take a file and I hand it to Cura and I slice it and I give it exactly the same arguments that I'm giving my program and I slice that, then I find that there's just a little bit less filament being used because all the lines are just a hair straighter. So there's just a little bit more precision in the approach that I've been using, which is honestly the kind of precision I'm looking for. So what is a straight skeleton? Why do we have to solve it? Why is any of this, why do so many slicers die here? So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to use a particular geometry displaying engine. This is a website that you can just grab a section of math that is written in JavaScript and throw it at it and get reasonable visualizations out of. So here, I'm running a rendering engine, so here's a triangle. I can actually put out a triangle in my rendering engine. Huzzah! So on this triangle, you can see there are, of course, 3 points, and there's also these lines that are going through the bisectors of each one of the angles. These lines are the straight skeleton of this triangle. So they are projected from the bisector of each one of the points, and they meet there at the middle, and there is a point there at the middle where they're always going to collide. So on a, oh, where is that? Oh, we'll go here. So if I take that triangle and I try to write a slightly smaller triangle on the inside of it, then, I want to make sure that the new triangle has edges that are a certain distance away from the outside triangle. Because if you sit down with a piece of graph paper and you put a square exactly on your graph paper, you're going to find that, if you measure that square, it's going to be off by just half of however wide the pencil or the pen or the marker or the crayon or the, or the whatever you have. It's going to be off by about half of that on each side, because what you're putting down has a different, has a width to it. So you have to inset something in order to get the outside point to be the outside point of the triangle, in this case, to be exactly at where you have said, I want material. I want this to be, 1 centimeter and no wider, not half a filament wide or half of the marker wide or half of the, not half of any of the components wide. So the straight skeleton is what you use to inset an object toward its point. So on this one, you can see that line that we had that came out of every point, that line always goes through a point of an inset object. So here is the same thing with, many, many triangles on the inside. And each one of those goes along the same straight skeleton. So all of the points of all of those triangles are always going to be on the straight skeleton. So here's a square. Same rules apply, right? We have points on the edges. Those points, we bisect the angles there, and this gives us our straight skeleton of the square. And there is one point in the middle that is its interior, that is an interior node where all of the lines meet, because they're always going to meet in the middle for a square or a regular triangle or any regular polygon. You're always going to have a point in the middle where all the bisectors meet. So same rules apply here. As the square gets smaller, the bisector is actually what is part of the straight skeleton, and that is what you always have to follow as it gets smaller. So, okay, so I make a thing and I make it smaller. Why is this so complicated? So we take a rectangle and do the same thing with it, right? Well, one, our points don't meet in the middle anymore. Our points are actually a little bit out to the side of the middle. And two, the ratio that we have between the top edge and the side edge of that, the ratio differs. So the ratio in the outside rectangle is a different ratio between the top and the side than the one on the inside here. So as the rectangle is getting smaller, it's sort of getting its shape distorted. It's no longer, you know, it's no longer the same rectangle. And as we go toward a point, we're going to find that at the middle of that, there is just a line. You know, each one of these sides here, that those are two, where the bisectors of those triangles' angles are meeting, they're on the left side and they're on the right side, those are interior nodes of our straight skeleton. And there is a, you know, just a little line in the middle, which is where everything would disappear. So drawing the straight skeleton of a convex contour. So any contour that we have that does not have, well, if you put a balloon around it, the balloon's going to touch all of the points, right? So when you're drawing a straight skeleton, you can basically just go through and go, well, what are the two, if I intersect every pair of rays in this, what's the two that are going to be the shortest intersection? And you start there. You take those, you put a point where they intersected, you throw away the nodes, and you repeat the process. So for instance, with our rectangle here, we might try, you know, start with, we know that we have two intersections, one on the left of the center and one on the right of the center. So we pick an intersection, we go, okay, I'm going to put a point there and forget about the nodes that are behind it. Now I have a line being emitted, or a ray being emitted from that new point, and in this case it is parallel to the axis here. So it is pointing directly to where the other two bisectors intersect. So we could go, okay, that line is a certain length and the other ones are longer, so we're gonna put a interior node there on the right hand side. And once we do that, then we have to deal with the last bisector there. So that last bisector will always intersect that node, so we can just use that, and we have a straight skeleton for this rectangle. So as I was saying, convex contours, it's reasonably easy to figure out. But whenever you end up with some sort of a concave edge on the contour, what do you do with this? So this is where the term motorcycle starts coming into play. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to remove everything on this figure that I don't need to do the math. So now we have just the downward angle itself, and then we have a wall, which is where when we emit a ray out of that downward angle, it runs into that wall. That ray there is called a motorcycle in projective or in straight skeleton terminology, and is impossible to Google. If you try to Google motorcycle, you are going to get nowhere when it comes to this terminology. So the motorcycle goes down and it runs into the opposing wall, and they have a concept of speed for the motorcycle. What is the speed of a motorcycle that is running into a wall? So the speed of a motorcycle that's running into a wall, they give it as the distance that the motorcycle would travel and then run into a point where if you took one of its input line segments if you took one of the input line segments to that motorcycle, one of the two line segments that is what produced it, and you moved it exactly one unit away, and you have a line there, so that line is still going to cross the motorcycle, and then you measured the distance in between where the motorcycle was emitted and where it runs into that line. That is your speed for this particular motorcycle. Now, in this case, the speed of this is going to be 1.41 something, 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 which I run into way too often in my math. And that is because this is the square root of 2, because we've created a triangle here. Let me find the math here. Yeah. So the line that is parallel, it runs into the parallel line one unit away, but because it had to travel on a diagonal, because it was emitted at a diagonal angle compared to that line, you're going to end up with effectively a 90-degree angle, and then you're crossing that 90-degree angle, so you have a 1 on one side of the 90-degree angle, you're impacting it 1 away, and your distance is actually, you know, a squared plus b squared equals something, something, something. So the important thing is here that the wall also has a speed. I know this makes absolutely no sense, but it is true in straight skeleton terminology. The wall itself has a speed, and that speed for this case is going to be 1. And it is the same rules apply here for the speed of the wall as they do for the motorcycle. You make a parallel line one unit away from the wall, and then you measure how long the motorcycle traveled between hitting the wall and hitting that line. And in this case, since they're at 90-degree angles with each other, the answer is it's 1, because it came straight down. So there's a way, using just these two things, to determine where the straight skeleton has to follow, which point it goes through, in order to go between the left side and the right side of our figure. You can calculate the point by using just the ratio of the speed of the motorcycle versus the speed of the wall. And then you can also do the same thing to calculate a line that goes through. So this means that we can, from just the ratio, again, exactly the same ratios, exactly the same math, we take the line segment that was on the way into the motorcycle, and we look at the line segment that we impacted, and we can use that to determine what the line in between is. It will intersect at the same point as these two segments intersect, and it will be the ratio between those two points between each other. So in this case, that's always going to go through that same point. So what this does is this divides our figure into two cells. And the important part here is that we can solve what's on the left-hand side and what's on the right-hand side separately, because we can determine what point the skeleton is going to go through, we can determine what line it's going to come in on, we can determine what line it's going to go out on, and this means that we can solve whatever complicated figure is on the left-hand side on one thread, and solve whatever complicated figure we have on the right-hand side on a completely different thread. So this gives us a parallel system of solving a straight skeleton. Anytime we have a motorcycle and it makes it all the way across, we can divide that into two threads, which divides up not only does it divide us into two threads, but it also means that each thread can do less work because it no longer has to look at the objects that are on the other side. So projective geometric algebra, how did that help at all? So you know all that complicated math I just had to do and probably did a very bad job of? So projective geometric algebra actually gives us a function, a set of functions that will just give you, I have two points, I want the point in between them, or more to the point, I want a point that has a ratio between the two points, which is our ratio between the motorcycle speed and the wall speed in this case. So there is a function you can use just to get that. And you can do the same thing on lines, which is what gives us our line segments. So that complicated, honestly, I couldn't draw that line in linear algebra, but projective geometric algebra, it just gives me a function that gives me that line. I just give it the ratio, and it tells me what the line should be. So I went through all this, but I'm running on a PC, and there's a floating point unit, and this is giving me error, right? Floating point units are the bane of software developers. So I implemented PGA just the same way everyone else does, using IEEE 754 floating point, which is it's a spec and it works, but it has its limitations. The important part is that on an x86 system, we basically have a couple of different modes we can use when actually doing a multiply. We can say, I want the real answer, or as close as you can get me to the real answer. We can say, I want as close as you can get, but it's okay if it's a little bit on the high side. And we can do the same thing and go, it's okay if it's a little bit on the low side. Just make sure that whatever the real answer is, it's, you know, above what you give me. And this means that we can use those to actually get an error bar. Because what we can do is ask for as close to the real number as you can get, and it'll store that, but it'll be off by some amount. And then we ask for, well, go ahead and give me the number that's a little bit higher than that, but just make sure that whatever the real answer is isn't higher than the number you give me. And then what we can do is we can look at the what's called the unit of least precision on that higher number. So the unit of least precision is basically you take the number and you get just the last bit of it, literally the last one of the bits of the fraction, and that will tell you approximately what the error range that your math actually is. So you will get a small number, but that small number will be larger than the amount of error that has occurred in your calculation. So yeah, that is the function that I'm doing here. Get the closest answer to the real answer. Get the closest answer that is above the real answer. Store the closest answer to the real answer. And store the unit of least precision of the closest answer above, because that will give you what your error amount is, mostly. So anytime you're doing an operation, you can look at this and decide what your error bars are. How much error have I got in this operation? And the complication here is, of course, that since you know what your error bars are, you can try to do some reasoning on that and say, you know, my line segment is so small that I'm trying to work with here that the error bars are, you know, they're so large, I can't tell the difference in between the beginning of this segment and the end of this segment. And so what you can do is you can call out to another library, potentially, you know, use a fixed point function for that. And this means that we can hybridize and use both the high-speed floating point units that we're used to having and also the, you know, the slower fixed point representations of these. Also, what you can do is something that something I kind of stole out of watching too many videos about video games, which is you can basically put a hit circle around what you're looking for and go, I'm going to get an answer, but it's not going to be the answer, you know, it's not going to be exact. So how big of a circle around my endpoint do I need to decide, well, it's close enough, so that means I hit it, right? So you basically just use a hitbox around it, or in this case, a hit circle, because you're using distance calculations. There will also be some error in your distance calculation, so that needs to hand you back the error, and then you take that back into your precision function, but you can know exactly how far away you are, or you know, approximately how far away you are, enough to reason. And that's the point, is being able to reason about this sort of geometry. So, as I said, this is a Haskell program, so I can abuse laziness, which means I can actually call the function and, you know, have a function do a piece of math, and then whenever the function is done with that piece of math, what I can do is I can also, at the same time in that function, call something that does it in a fixed point engine, and then look in box A and decide, you know, my error amount for this is just too much, and then dereference what's in box B without having to go back and do the calculation, because Haskell will do that for you. It's lazy, it's not going to do its homework until it's actually due. So how do I know any of this worked? Because there's floating point engines and there's imprecision everywhere and it gets complicated. So what I've been doing is I use property tests for all of this. I've been doing a property test driven development system, which is it's been 3 years now, so it's not exactly the fastest way to develop software, but it is the most precise way to develop it. So what happens is I give a function to my testing system and say, you know, this function will generate a square. And what you do is it will generate a square given random information anywhere. So it'll generate a square at a various angle. It'll generate a square in a random location. And so what you do is you give the testing system a tool that says, okay, this is a square. Well, what properties do a square have? Well, there should be four sides to it. Those sides should have 90-degree angles. The bisectors of all those angles should meet in the middle of the object. You know, there are properties that you can test, even though you have created this thing from completely random input. And so that's how a property testing engine can be assisting in this. There are a ton of property tests for this engine. I think I've written about 260 right now. And that's kind of been required just to make sure that all the code stays working while I go fix for the next test and fix for the next test and fix for the next test. And so when I'm property testing geometry, what I've done is I create a function which just takes a set of inputs, radian and distance. So if I'm creating a square, I would use the same distance and I would use radians that are across from each other. So I create a function that takes radian and distance and builds an object out of it. And then I use a property test against that to test the properties. So to summarize, in order for 3D printing to help more people, we need to focus on our slicers. The companies that are producing our 3D printers, they're interested in selling you a device. They're not necessarily interested in moving the state of the art forward. More parallel algorithms for slicing are possible. The math is a bit complicated, but it does work. Projective geometric algebra can be used with, you know, less precision loss than linear algebra, I think, by having sets of three datums instead of two datums. I think I have more data. So property testing is necessary if you want to keep all of this working, because this is floating point, and floating point is hard and easy to break. And I want you to be able to write a slicer in less than the 3 years this has taken me. Any questions?
Yeah, you can applaud. Thank you very much. So, as we are probably already out of time because we started about 20 minutes late and we would have about 2 minutes for questions, so I would say if you have any questions, you will probably be around. Where? Where can you, anyone find you?
Food Hacking Base.
Okay, Food Hacking Base. So if anyone wants to ask some questions or talk about slicers, please go and find Julia. And I think it was worth the wait, so thank you very much again.